show you're about to listen to has been sponsored by Fairway Market. And now you can shop online at fairwaymarket.com. Once again, the show is sponsored by Fairway Market. And also check out NBC in New York, Channel 4, weekdays at 5 p.m. We'll be cooking with Fairway's very own food experts, Danny Glickberg and Mitchell London. That's every Thursday, 5 p.m. on New York 4. It's hosted by Sarah Gore. Patrick, Katie.
Oh, hi. Right,
thanks, Jack.
My jaw was open with admiration at Fairway's industriousness in getting their name out there. God bless Fairway. Thank you very much for your sponsorship.
Like no other market.
They're like no other market. And that I say that from the very bottom of my heart. I've been shopping at Fairway for about 25 years and have loved it. I had a personal relationship with the cheesemongers there. Not just Steve Jenkins,
had a personal relationship with him?
Well, practically.
Didn't he take his shirt off last time he was here?
He did show his tummy.
Oh my God.
It was kind of furry.
All right.
I love Steve Jenkins so much. He's such a great guy.
Well, we have a special guest sitting in studio with us.
First, we have to say this is the main course, part Q.
Which might eventually just become part of the main course.
I think so. But for now, we're still calling it part Q. And the reason we call it part Q is because although this particular hour is going to be devoted to the meat industry, in subsequent hours in the future, we'll be talking with booksellers, with authors, with musicians, with, you know, sort of a magazine sort of format where we have a little bit more leeway than just staying on the topic of sustainable.
That is interesting.
I think it's going to be really great, Patrick. It's going to be fabulous. Anyway, we are, I'm Katie Kiefer and
I'm Patrick Martins.
And we have West and Red in the studio with us today, which always adds good energy to the program. We have the doggies here. And we have, of course, the lovely Anastasia.
Cole Plakius.
Hi, how are you?
Is that right? Cole Plakius?
Mm-hmm.
Who's the Cole?
It's my middle name, Nicole.
Oh.
Yeah.
And Plakius is your...
My Greek last name.
I was going to say, boy, is that Greek.
Yeah.
Are your parents still married?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
They are.
Wow.
Happily.
After isn't that lovely?
Many, many years.
I love that.
That's poliodeo, as the Greeks say. That means beautiful.
Really?
So, this is very interesting. I mean, there's been a slew. There's always a slew of meat articles, but...
But today...
There's a lot of them. Today, yeah. What was today's
today in New York Times, there was a long article about the rise in consumer interest in the art and craft of butchering. So what the writer was talking about was how consumers are now taking their own personal classes, whether it's in San Francisco, upstate New York, or Brooklyn. Various butchers like Tom Mylan, it said in the article, formerly of Marlowe and Daughters. I wasn't aware that he had left his position there, but
just
I guess
he did.
Just
6 months ago. I guess that news hasn't
Oh, my God. I just didn't. I wrote an article about him.
Recently?
Well, it published in July, so... He was still there then. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Because I had to call him to do some fact-checking, like, in June. So, but anyway, and then there's Fleischer's up in Kingston, New York. They taught Tom Mylan how to butcher, and they've taught a lot of other restaurant chefs, and they have a program now that costs $10,000.
Anastasia, what do you think of that? I mean, we were saying $10,000.
It's just more than most people can afford. It really plays into this sort of... The opposition's idea that this kind of eating is for the
elitist.
Bourgeois, it's elitist.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
I mean, I guess they had Tom Mylan, who's a famous graduate, so they
figured... I don't think that Tom paid 10 grand.
No, but he lived there. No, it was really cool what he did, but
he
it
lived
seems
there for
like
three
they
weeks
were using
and he learned
that
how to butcher.
To now get $10,000.
Yes.
And they claim that it's just to cover their costs, but I can't imagine that...
Yeah, I mean, there are other classes going on. Novella Carpenter of Ghost Town Farms in Oakland does a rabbit class for $100 a person. You go and you kill a rabbit, you prepare it, you know, you skin it, you truss it up, and that's $100 a person. Still not, you know, still more than a lot of people can afford, but... It's also, you know, it's something a bit more practical. It gives you the experience of killing a rabbit that you can then go home and raise yourself versus these classes where you're killing pigs. It's like, you know, who's really raising pigs on their own?
Right.
So maybe those folks paying $10,000, they're going to go into butchering as a profession.
As a life skill, then it's probably a good investment. I mean, it's certainly cheaper than going to the CIA, which is what, $40,000, $45,000 a year now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you could say it as comparison to learning another culinary skill, sure, 10 grand isn't so bad. I don't know. It didn't say in the article how long the courses
I think it's just an hour.
8 weeks.
Come on.
It's 8 weeks. It's accommodations. It's you know, the cost of materials. So
I don't think that's so bad.
No, if it's 8 weeks, then I didn't remember reading that. That's not so bad.
Yeah, I did not read that either. That was not in the article. But Anastasia clearly has the inside track.
Hey, Patrick, we've been confused back here. Just to clarify, it's $10,000 for an 8-week course at Fleischer's. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's okay. What we're hearing here.
You get their couch, but it opens up to a bed, I hear.
I'm sure they have better accommodations. No wonder
that's
they
charged 10
grand. They probably had to build a guest house.
Tom Mylan did it that way. I think he just...
He did. He stayed on the couch, yeah. But there are other classes in Brooklyn. They cited another... instructor, I can't remember his name now, but Riojas or something like that.
Is that a wine, a Spanish wine?
I know, I want to say Rioja, but it was R-U-I-S-H-A-S, I think, was the way it was spelled.
Well,
it's in the New York Times article.
What do you think of this whole do-it-yourself butcher thing? I mean, where does it come from, and like, where is it going to go?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of folks who are doing they're calling it the DIY butcher. You know, I think it's an attempt for people to get closer to the meat that they're eating. I think a lot of people who have ethical issues with meat feel that some of those are absolved when you're looking the animal in the eye, when you're making a real connection to it. In the killing stage, you know, the slaughtering stage, people feel that, you know, they're preventing these animals from ending up on the slaughterhouse floor. You know, I think there's really not too much of an ethical basis for that argument unless you're going to do that with every piece of meat that you kill. Like, from now on, are you going to go and spend some time with every chicken that you eat and before you, you know,
before you wring its neck?
Right. probably not. You know, at some point, you're going to hit up
not
the key
only that, I don't want to. I mean, but Anastasia, can you tell us, give us a little bit of background on yourself before we go further into this discussion? Because you're, I mean, obviously you know what you're talking about, and I don't really know who you are.
Yeah. You
she's
know,
a household name in many circles.
I see.
Uh-huh. I'm somebody who really loves food. I grew up here in the city, and I had the pleasure of growing up in a household where my mom really cared about the food that she raised us on. So, you know, we would go to do our shopping, and this is, you know, very, very unique to a New York lifestyle, but we would hit our butcher and our bakery and, you know, the produce spot and Murray's cheese and Zito's bread and Raffetto's for pasta. Then I went up to Vassar for college. We're Patrick's alma mater as well.
Yes, we're both, and, you graduated.
Anthony Bourdain, too, by the way.
You actually graduated?
Briefly, yeah. Unlike Anthony Bourdain, I actually graduated.
So did Jane Fonda.
So did my friend Jody Wilkie.
For a year, I heard.
Well, you know, it was very depressing up there because it was like, this is where all the produce that I'd been buying with my mom from the Union Square Green Market, this is where it was all coming from. And then we would go to the cafeteria and it was all Aramark food. It was all stuff that was being shipped in from South America out of season. And
why don't we go up
crazy
there and start a revolution where they, I don't
well,
know.
Well, a lot of college campuses although are starting better that revolution. There's quite a few colleges that are really pushing hard for local,
sustainable. So you were depressed.
Yeah, I was depressed, and it got me thinking about the food that we eat. And then I started realizing this is what you spend the bulk of your money on. I mean, after rent, you're spending the most amount of money on food. So in a capitalist society, you know, I mean, in a capitalist democracy, you're voting with your dollar, and if the largest chunk of your income is getting spent on food, you're not, let's face it, you're not making a difference by cutting your landlord check.
But actually, the Americans spend less money on their food budget than any other country in the world.
Sure.
The French spend upwards of 1/4 to...
Because they're always eating foie gras.
One-third, not even. But,
no, I'm kidding.
I mean, yeah, you know that. You know, in Western Europe, certainly, countries, all those citizens spend much more for their food. And what we have voted for with our dollar is commodity foods.
Absolutely.
Commodity beef, commodity produce, commodity chickens.
Well, I have an
chickens.
Interesting question just to contextualize this. And maybe we could ask, we're produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by E.J. Dukoski. And then we have Jacqueline Block sitting in. I would ask this to everybody. What percentage, just lunch and dinner, because breakfast doesn't count. Although, you know, I guess it could.
It's the
lunch
most important
dinner
meal of the day.
Okay, so then 21, 7 times 3, 21 meals. How many meals have meat in them for you out of 21? And then I'll ask everybody. I mean, I'll start.
See,
5.
Luckily,
five.
We eat at Roberta's so often. So
you only get a margarita pizza with one topping?
Exactly. And it's your meat.
What? Okay, so you what? What's your answer, Jack?
Probably 7, because...
7 out of 21.
Yeah, I'd say.
EJ?
I'd say like 18, probably.
I like it. Me too. What
yeah,
do you?
I mean, does a handful of chopped pancetta in a dish of pasta count? You
it's
know,
a good
I mean,
question.
This is a good question. Like chicken broth. Like, you know, what are we talking
right.
about here? I eat very little. You know, it's very rare that I get a piece of meat and prepare.
You like it very rare.
I do when I just kidding. I like it rarely and I like it rare.
I think that's kind of the model we you know that I certainly what that's that catchphrase of eat a little meat, not too much, and mostly vegetables. I mean,
I eat a lot of meat.
You do. I'm Curtis eats
vegetables.
A lot of meat too. My
I
man
worry.
Friend, yeah, he eats a ton of meat, and he does not like to eat vegetables.
Is
either.
He unhealthy as a result? I mean, no, but I'm asking. Like, I wonder.
Have you seen the-
Can someone go? I mean, what happens if you eat meat 18 out of 21 meals for 50 years? I mean, you have to really rely on your genetics at that point. I bet to
yeah,
save you.
Yeah, I think so. But I think you have to rely on your genetics in any case. I mean, I think you can eat the healthiest diet in the world and still die of cancer. I mean, I think that...
But that's less. I think that's less of a worry. Yeah,
well,
you might just have a bad sickness.
And now we're also getting into the real cost of meat. So, I mean, if you can afford to eat that much meat, then you're eating really cheap and
you're
inexpensively
commodity
produced.
Beef.
Right.
Yeah.
And then
yes.
we're talking about the real cost, because then it's not... Mm-hmm. It's not just the cost of the cheap meat that you're buying, but it's the health costs down the road, and especially with the healthcare system being what it is, you're going to pay for that. You really are.
Yeah, there's so many side effects. Well, I mean, look at this woman. I mean, Stephanie Smith was a children's dance instructor.
Right.
And
this
she
is,
thought she had
this
a,
is referring back to the New York Times story on E. coli.
A different article.
A few weeks ago.
October
yeah,
4th.
which rattled the meat industry like, oh my God, nobody's
business.
Well,
it was
business.
A cover story.
It was a cover story, and then there was a follow-up program on Larry King Live.
Really? With her?
No, not with her, but with representatives of the meat industry. And also, strangely enough, Anthony Bourdain.
And was that the one with Jonathan Safran Foer as well, I believe?
No, I don't know. I didn't read his name in the lineup.
Well, he was very upset with Anthony Bourdain because evidently they had a conversation backstage before the Larry King show. And Jonathan Safran Foer just wrote a book on... the ethics of eating meat.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he and
Tony mixed it up.
They were chatting, and Anthony Bourdain expressed that, you know, he's very upset with the conditions of meat consumption in this country right now, and then completely changed his tune on the air and did his, you know, all this, like, very twee, like, you know, ethical eating stuff really sticks in my craw, and Jonathan Safran Foer was very upset, so... That's,
oh, how
you know,
interesting.
Yeah,
I didn't
yeah.
read that.
Yeah.
So he was going to go in saying that, like, he's, you know, concerned about the problems, and then he went in there basically criticizing the only solution that's going on.
And then towed
the only
party
reaction.
Line.
Yeah, I haven't been able to find a clip of it online,
you know what?
So it's all hearsay.
You
but.
Can find it on meetingplace.com.
Who was on? Can we pull that up? Or Jack, can you pull that up for us?
Unfortunately, I cannot. Jack,
we're,
you would...
We're working on it.
Who was the
you'd
CNN?
Have a problem. Well, call... Yeah, look up CNN in their archives.
Jack doesn't have a TV. CNN is a 24-hour news station. Channel 10 on my
but yeah, look up Larry King Live and the they had Richard Raymond from the American Meat Institute and
what
no.
is American Meat Institute?
Well, the American Meat Institute and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association are the two big trade organizations for the cattle industry. There's also a third entity or organization called RCAF, and I don't recall what that acronym stands for, but they are sort of more in the camp of shall we say less commodity beef as qua commodity beef in terms of like the number of heads of cattle that are squashed into feedlots.
They're better.
Yeah, RCAF is definitely a better organization.
RCAF.
Yeah, and they've done a lot. They've been trying very hard, I think, to sort of push the industry into a more responsible position towards how they handle beef, how
really?
They handle
and yet
cattle.
They're a big company. They're not the biggest, but they're a big, big company.
It's a trade organization. It's not one particular company. It is a multitude of companies who have found reasons to dispute the political stance and the practices of the American Meat Institute and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
I would love to find out producers are part of that. Guys, can you find that out for us? Which group is part of CCAF?
We've got your RCAF. Larry King Live clip. How about that?
Oh, okay.
So who was on that?
This is the Anthony Bourdain and Jonathan Safran Foer.
Ah.
A recent article on the front page of the New York Times headlined "The Burger That Shattered Her Life" chronicled the story of 22-year-old Stephanie Smith. In the fall of 2007, her nervous system was ravaged. She was left paralyzed after unknowingly eating an E. coli-tainted ground meat patty. Bill, I know you represent her. What's her situation?
Well, she just entered into a rehab center today.
So this is the panel. I don't know if you guys want to hear the whole panel, but this is where Anthony...
Well, give us a couple more minutes.
6 months. They're going to work, you know,
I want to hear
hard,
who the next
therapy,
person is
occupational
right after
therapy.
This.
But she's
be
got
the
a
reaction.
Long road to hoe. She's got risk of kidney failure. She suffered brain damage. And, you know, whether she'll walk again is another thing.
If this is a major problem, why aren't there more Stephanies?
Well, there are more Stephanies. We grossly undercount the number of people that are sick.
Why?
Well, partly because... you know, we've really gutted the ability for the CDC, local and state health departments, to surveil foodborne illness. There are a lot of Stephanies, there's a lot of Abbeys, there's a lot of Kevins. They just don't necessarily get tied to a particular hamburger.
Let's see
patty.
If he interviews
Barbara, what happened to Kevin?
In August 2001,
okay, well, maybe let's try
Kevin
to cut ahead then.
Contracted E.
Let's come back to the conversation here. People can access this interview on CNN's archives.
That was good that you found that.
I urge you all to listen to it. But I think another thing to think about in terms of the E. coli controversy is you can go to the CDC website and they do track the illnesses. The fact is that most people, when they are in the grips of food poisoning, frequently don't recognize that that's what it is, and therefore it is often underreported, particularly in the less severe cases. When somebody,
she barely caught it. I mean, they had a really tough time finding
it. They didn't know what it was.
And if the grandmother hadn't had a burger still lying around
right,
in the fridge,
they would never have been able to test it.
Yeah, and exactly. So I think a lot of people just get sick.
And once again, I'm going to promote this site, meetingplace.com.
How do you spell that? M-E-A-T?
Yeah. M-E-A-T, Meeting Place.
Just making sure.
And the reason it's important to read this is, and you don't have to read every single article on it, but every virtually once, twice, or three times a week, there is a news report of a recall, either due to faulty inspection, E. coli presence, or listeria. These are two, E. coli and listeria being two of the major foodborne illnesses. That assail people from the meat, from specifically the cattle industry. Listeria, of course, comes from all kinds of sources, and so does E. coli. But one of the things that when you read this, and I'm going to read some of the material from this in a little while, from Meeting Place, is that, you know, people are encouraged to blog after they read an article, and so you'll see blog after blog after blog entries saying, well, the consumer should have, you know, cooked it to 160 degrees. Well, one of the things that the New York Times article said is to debunk that theory that you can't necessarily cook E. coli out of your product. And more importantly, it's something that stays on your cutting board. It stays on your knife.
And
it
the
stays,
New York Times did a study on that, and it proved that even just the littlest amount
even just
sticks
the littlest
to a
bit,
towel.
Which is why it's really important to have, for instance, I mean, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I have separate plastic cutting boards for meat, which I run through my dishwasher.
You don't use wood at all?
I use wood for everything but meat.
Okay.
Anyway, to go back to the main thing here is the moral of the story here is that, first of all, when you buy a ground beef patty, when you buy those boxes of ground beef patties, you are literally taking your life in your hands. You should always know, this is once again speaks to this, you should always know the source of your food. Always know where it comes from, whether it's your seafood or whether it's your beef or your poultry, because those ground beef patties are coming from multitudes of different sources. There's meat scraps and trim that are coming in from South America, from China, any place that grows cattle. They are not necessarily subject to the same rules and regulations that are. They're pulled together with American beef sources, and then they're all ground in these big machines and formed into those patties. And it's really, really, really hard to control.
Well, I mean, this New York Times piece, I mean, it talked about, I mean, there was like five different places that it could have come from, that hamburger, including Uruguay. Mm-hmm. You know, where the USDA has a much tougher time enforcing.
And ground beef is rarely inspected. In other words, it's not inspected. It's random sampling. It's not that every single beef patty that comes out of a plant is going to be tested for E. coli. It's not.
And in fact,
it is random sampling, and that name says what it is.
And the big issue in this article was that they only are the associations like Cargill only want to test it once.
That's right.
After all five slaughterhouse stuff is already part of that burger, so there's no way to trace it.
There's no traceability there. You don't know where it came from.
And then all those. So I guess you would either... And then if you do a recall on all five plants, that could be victimizing four innocent plants.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the meat industry, it's a funny place. I'm going to, a little further on into this discussion, or maybe very soon, assuming my computer hasn't just completely died on me, we're going to read a little bit of the responses to some of these issues, because what we're dealing with here is the producers, the people who actually produce beef. Many of them are fabulous. They're great. Mm-hmm. They take their animal husbandry really seriously.
It's a generational business.
Absolutely. And I certainly don't want to cast aspersions on the family farm or anything else. But where the responsibility really lies, in my opinion, is with the beef packer. And that's the slaughterhouse, mm-hmm, and the people who are pushing those cattle through the inspection system at a rate of something like 3,000 carcasses an hour.
Yeah.
An hour, folks. This is on the USDA website. You can check out these figures yourself. This is an untenable business today.
Yeah, it's like an hourglass. Everything comes through the slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can understand how that would make somebody just not want to eat meat. But for me, that's a call to arms right there. That says to me, that says there is something happening in this country and we need to voice our opposition to it.
The fact is that there are four major...
That's what I wanted.
There are four major slaughterhouses in this country, or four major beef packers in this country.
Cargill.
National.
And by the way, Cargill is $116 billion in revenues last year, making it the country's largest private company. And what I liked about this article is it didn't attack. It was a very correct, good journalism. And they kept talking about how much money they save through this insane five-packer hamburger patty. And it's basically, it was like 20 cents a pound less that they save. And I think by revealing actual prices, which most articles fail to do because you really have to do your research, it's almost like Fast Food Nation type research, it shows basically they can't save that 20 cents. That's where the problem is. You just have to do whole muscle meat burgers rather than the scraps from four slaughterhouses.
Yeah, bench trim, which is now being incorporated into our ground beef market. And let's backtrack for a second. It's really expensive to raise cattle. It's really expensive to raise any animal protein, actually. And in order to do it well, the American public has to realize that if you want a better quality product, you have to pay a little more for it. And the more people are willing to pay that extra 25 cents, 50 cents a dollar a pound.
It's about not making the other option even available. Even the cheapest option should be decent. There shouldn't be a dangerous option.
Right.
I would agree with you there.
Yeah, but then that's going to take time, but it's also going to take conscious meat eaters. It's not going to take vegetarians, because the demand for meat in this country is never going to disappear. So,
and
it's
the
a
demand
question of
for
whether,
cheap meat is never going to disappear.
So, but it's about changing people's concept of the bottom line is and what cheap meat is, because like I said, it's the real cost is being ignored. So it's a question of whether you want to engage in the dialogue at all. If you want to abstain and be a vegetarian, fine, you get no vote. Yeah. And as far as I'm concerned, that's hurting the fight against these sort of agribusinesses and these,
Right. Absolutely.
Massive.
Well, this line, to reinforce what we're saying, using a combination of sources, meaning slaughterhouse, a practice followed by more large producers of fresh and packaged hamburger, allowed Cargill to spend about 25% less than it would have for cuts of whole meat. So by basically forcing it to come to one slaughterhouse, that doesn't seem like the most impossible political battle to win. Just saying you can't get it from three countries and five different processors. So basically you would lose that 25% less option at the grocery store, mm-hmm, and then everything would hopefully be more decent. Because if it's there, the cheapest, even I would be tempted sometimes to buy.
Well, of course. I was in Costco yesterday, and believe me, I bought a pack of boneless short ribs, mm-hmm, for, you know, $13. It was $4 a pound or something, which is, that's commodity beef. It's, you know, $2 a pound less than it is in the average grocery store. I'll be cooking it up.
So, you know, so if meat's 25% more expensive, if that's the, if the cheapest meat is 25% more than it currently is, people eat maybe, what, 25% less meat.
That's not bad
either. It's not bad at all, you know? It's clearly our country needs a dietary shift here.
Guys, can you do the research on the five biggest packers besides Aramark and Cargill?
We'll have it after the break.
Okay, awesome. We're going to take a break right now.
And then
now,
you'll read from Meeting
Place. And then
we'll
come back with Meeting Place and the whole controversy around Michael Pollan.
Cool.
And all that stuff. So the difference you made me a good time. And we're back. This is Main Course Part Q. I'm Katie Kiefer with Patrick Martins, and we have Anastasia Nicole
Plakius.
Plakius.
That's a good great
Sorry.
Name.
Sorry. Plakius. I love that.
Look, I guess the theme of the show has kind of gotten some bad energy around with the local birds.
And we're talking about the American Meat Institute, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, RCAF, E. coli, and all the controversy that is swirling around the protein industry in the United States today. This is the Main Course Part Q. We're sponsored by Fairway, like no other market.
And they have great, great butcher section there.
They do. They do.
Oh, yeah.
And we started off the program talking about the trend towards the DIY butcher, which I think is hilarious. I can't imagine anybody. I worked in a butcher shop for 5 years, and I learned my fair share of butchering. We got, every once in a while,
you
we would get a whole lamb.
Lambs.
We had suckling pigs.
No, did you ever do suckling lambs?
No.
Like this one?
Not quite like that, although I have had meadow-raised veal. Yeah, thank you, Patrick, because I might have had to kill you with the crying baby in the first hour.
Do,
and
you, do you guys remember the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, what they really, how they made their barbecue sauce so good?
No, I don't, because I never
it
saw
had
that.
A certain meat in it that it shouldn't have.
Would that be long
it had human.
Pig?
They had human meat. That was the whole thing. That's why they killed the people. They were making food out of it. It was maybe ahead of its
so
time.
So it was very
as a
sustainable.
Comment.
Yeah.
They were a Texas Chainsaw Massacre churning out barbecue.
But anyway, so this in this part of the show, we wanted to move on from the DIY butchering, which, you know, is kind of a hilarious But also, I think a good trend in consumers. I think it's good for people to recognize that food doesn't come in little styrofoam trays in a, or a cryovac pack.
Hachi machi.
And, you know, and actually an animal does die for your pleasure. That doesn't mean that I want to be the one killing it in spite of my enjoyment. I have to say, I really enjoyed butchering. It sort of brought out the surgeon monkey in me. I really like good knife skills. And it is a fact that there are very few butchers left in Manhattan, although there are lots of them now in Brooklyn. But in Manhattan, the butcher shop that I worked for was called the Broadway Butcher. It was on 90th and Broadway. And we went away because our landlord didn't want to renew our lease. And then shortly after that, Nevada Meats closed, which was a wonderful shop on 68th Street. And then finally, Harry Oppenheimer threw in the towel and sold his wonderful business, Oppenheimer's on 100th Street, to a real jerk named Robert Pence, who basically ran the business into the ground. And there are very few...
Don't tag that, Jack.
The only...
Poor guy.
Go right ahead. He was such a jerk. I hated him. But
why? Because you had once asked him to put aside some short ribs for you, and he didn't, and then you got in your big dinner
party. No, because he had icky business practices. Ooh. He was abusive to his customers. He screwed around my friends Michelle and Eleanor Guiton, who had owned Broadway Butcher, and we basically gave him our database, and there was like no acknowledgement of that. But there is a wonderful butcher shop left. Aside from the high-end ones on the east side, there's Lenny Simchek's shop over on Sutton Place.
That was right by my house.
Yeah. Do you know Lenny Simchek?
Yeah. I mean, he is there.
He is
a fixture in the neighborhood,
for sure. Well, his chief butcher, Paul Redder, the guy with the...
Big guy.
Is he big?
Yeah. Tall, I mean.
Oh, Lenny is, yeah. Paul is a tall guy, too. Yeah. He's the one with the mullet.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, right.
He copied at Jimbo's.
He was our chief butcher at Broadway Butcher, and he and I worked side by side for 5 years. Absolutely adore him.
I'm also, you know, I'm a big fan of Pino's in Soho, and that's there are some folks who've been doing the sort of apprentice system for a long, long time before before the sort of civilian foodie population got into it. They've been training cooks to make sausage. I mean, so many chefs send, you know, a cook there to apprentice with these guys to learn how to make sausage. And so they've really
been... Fantastic.
Yeah, they've been...
We're going to have all five Ottomanelli brothers here one of these coming Sundays.
Oh, cool.
So, Anastasia, you should come back for that.
Those are my guys growing up.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
so you were right, West Village?
West Village.
Well, we're going to... Let's turn our attention right now to a very interesting and sort of ancillary topic that has been rocking some of us in the food world. And that was... a kind of interesting situation that arose at Cal Polytech in San Luis Obispo. And recently, they scheduled a lecture by sustainable food advocate Michael Pollan at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. This has now turned into a panel discussion after the Harris Ranch Beef Company chairman, David Wood, threatened to pull donations from the school. This is according to the Los Angeles Times. Instead of a Pollan speech, the school on Thursday will hold a panel discussion including Pollan, a meat scientist, and a representative of one of the nation's largest organic growers. This is not Michael Pollan. These are two other separate individuals. And now it goes on to say, oops, I just lost this. While I understand the need to expose students to alternative views, I find it unacceptable that the university would provide Michael Pollan an unchallenged forum to promote his stand against conventional agricultural practices, end quote, Wood reportedly wrote in a letter to Cal Poly's president. Wood, according to the LA Times, has pledged $150,000 to help build a new meat processing plant on the Cal Poly campus. But in his letter, he said the Pollan lecture caused him to, quote, rethink my continued financial support of the university. David Wehner, a Cal Poly dean, is quoted as saying the backlash prompted the university to propose holding a panel directly after Pollan's speech. But Pollan...
That's nice of them, because they took his into account, but they didn't try to break from the original idea.
Well, Pollan told the LA Times originally that he offered Cal Poly a choice of either having him lecture or participate in a panel. Pollan further said that Wood's letter posed a threat to academic freedom. Quote, the issue is about whether the school is really free to explore diverse ideas about farming. Is the principle of balance going to apply across the board the next time Monsanto comes to speak at Cal Poly about why we need genetically modified organisms to feed the world? Will there be a similar effort I'm going to put in parentheses here, to find alternative and potentially opposing points of view.
Monsanto is wrong, and Pollan is right, and we all know that. So that's why.
You know, I never think of these issues as being so black and white.
Well, you're right.
I think of them as being, you know, we have an enormous population that is growing, as we learned last week from one of our guests. By the year 2050, we need to be able to increase our agricultural output by 70%, 70%.
So then Monsanto can't be all that bad.
Monsanto is not all that bad.
It's just their tactics, I should say.
Sure. I mean, everybody who saw Food Inc. sees how Monsanto, you know, victimizes farmers who don't use their, or who try to grow their own seed if they've grown once from Monsanto and so forth. And certainly those are reprehensible practices. Mm-hmm. And there's also, I'd say, probably some question about their sort of delivering seeds to countries, to developing countries, where the crops that they are advocating are perhaps not necessarily indigenous to that environment, or may have some aspect of ecological change or imbalance in that environment. But nevertheless, there's no question the population is going to continue to grow, and we are going to have to find ways to feed it. So agriculture,
I mean, yeah, and there are definitely other ways other than genetically modified foods. And, you know,
I don't know. I mean, I'm not enough of a food scientist to know whether that's true or not. What I'm saying is that I think that there's a place for industrialized agriculture in the world, a
yes.
big place for it.
Yes.
But what I think is reprehensible about industrialized agriculture is that it has focused so exclusively on their bottom line, and it is less about maintaining sustainable practices. I mean, I hate that word now. It's like so overused. But responsible agriculture has become something that has been taking the backseat to profit. And that, I think, is what we're all feeling now as we see the environmental impact of the gross agricultural practices, like when we were speaking with Duckworth earlier in the program and the first part of the main course, when he was talking about, and I said, what are the biggest problems in terms of you know, runoff into the water? It's all agricultural runoff. It's the fertilizers are creating dead zones in our waterways.
I think also, you know, Monsanto wants a monopoly on the food crisis, which is just crazy. You know, I think if we have an open dialogue, just like, you know, just like this gentleman wanted a monopoly on this conversation at UCal Poly San Luis Obispo.
We'll get back to that.
It's basically like Monsanto doesn't want to consider the sort of smaller approaches to the growing need for agricultural.
Which is why you've taken things into your own hands, right, Anastasia?
We're going right off the grid, and we're building a farm in Brooklyn on a roof. It's going to be a for-profit, you know, ecologically and fiscally sustainable business.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, absolutely.
So like Gotham Greens. But you're not going to be hydroponic.
No. We're really into growing in the soil. We experiment with a couple different tactics, but the bottom line is, you know, we want to do it in such a way that it's really replicable, so people can do this everywhere, and people can see that you can set up these businesses, you can employ people, you can make money.
Yes.
Not a lot, but you can, you know, you can turn aside. They don't have to be nonprofits. They don't have to be these little pockets of idealism. They can actually be a part of the sort of the market.
Being part of the market, that's so awesome, and I think it's really what distinguishes businesses that are making a change versus businesses that are well-intentioned, but, you know, when they do take that first step of risking money, basically,
right,
you know,
right.
I mean, that's, and reputation, and, you know, they're putting a name to something. It's a big jump.
The one thing that's a lot harder that you can't really do on a roof in Brooklyn, you can't raise cattle, you can't raise hogs. You can have chickens, you can have rabbits, you can even have goats.
But
look, like I said, the demand for meat in this country is never going to disappear. People are going to want to continue to eat pork. Yeah. I mean, hell, I want to continue to eat pork. Once in a while, I like a nice steak. So, you know, I think that we do need a dialogue, because we need to sort of address the way, you know, also especially with how we've set farmers up to be reliant on government subsidies in this country. It's unfair to expect everybody to switch over to this very small production, organic and, you know, family farming practice of specialty foods that has thus far really only been successful in middle and upper middle class and upper class.
Yeah, and before that really ends up feeding the world, I mean, I think it's both. It's as many of those reactions as possible, you know, in the marketplace, and also the slow-moving, trudging, strategic forward steps of government regulating, moving things in the right direction. But, you know, in a weird way, as big as they are and as small as the things we're doing or that you're doing with that garden, like, they're so on the same plane, you know, they're arm in arm, you know, trying to make things better.
Right, which is evidently what you know, there's been so much opposition to Michael Pollan out there by people who say he's anti-agriculture, which is a really interesting claim to make about Michael Pollan, if you think about it. He's anti-agriculture. I mean, the man is consumed by an interest in how this world produces, packages, transports, and consumes
let me read you a blog here of somebody who posted on the subject of Michael Pollan in the wake of this controversy. This was posted by Delhi Snob. Mr. Pollan's objective is to stay in the news in order to sell his next book. This is just reality. He's a journalist. He's not opposed to a panel. He was just on NPR with the Farm Bureau talking about trade-offs in food production. Let's not vilify. Let's get the conversation going to, one, start getting the ag facts out there so the euphoric greens have to start thinking in terms of trade-offs. And two, let's make sure that the new Pollan bestseller is going to be along the lines of joining the two camps together. Remember, he's a journalist, not a farmer, a rancher, or a greenie. I have read his books. He wants to make bank. So let's make sure that his follow-up to In Defense of Food is something along the lines of the amazing progression of U.S. food production.
And by the way, I think he lives very modestly. I think he lives very modestly.
Well, I don't think it matters. I mean, I think, you know, this person is actually at least semi-informed about the issues and is willing to
I mean, it is true that Michael Pollan's greatest challenge is that, you know, how his work can be, you know, concretized and made tangible and implemented, you know, without the trade-offs. Because normally once you already start with 10,000 pigs, which could maybe feed 10 schools, right off the bat, there's probably going to be a few trade-offs. You know, reality is different than philosophy.
It is. I mean, you know, as I said before, it's like we have a huge population. We have to grow our ability to grow food exponentially over the next 30, 40 years. So we can't just toss the industrial agricultural system out of the window. It can't, you know, it just, we have to get larger crop yields. But we also have to go in directions of things like the vertical farming projects, rooftop gardens like you're talking about, Anastasia, and that our guest last week was talking about with Gotham Greens and various other projects that are happening. Sustainable aquaculture is another big avenue that we're that the country is following. And I think these are all great developments. Mm-hmm. And these are all, you know, big agricultural systems that we're creating. But what's disheartening about it is that there is in the middle of the country this feeling it's like every piece of criticism that is leveled towards protein producers is viewed by many of their practitioners as sort of an arrow aimed straight at the heart of the industry, and it's all these crazy yuppies and greenies and here's another post that I thought was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. The oops forgot one. This was posted by John Munsell, who's actually a very thoughtful poster on this blog. The biggest problem is, quote, who gets to define the word sustainable? His methods, I guess that's Pollan, are not very sustainable for the starving millions. They likely are for the suburban yuppies. This is the same problem we have with HSUS. This is the Humane Society of the United States. And PETA. They have gained the ability to define humane as it relates to animal agriculture. It is a disgrace that they can hoodwink the masses, take their money, and then force us to change methods that are proven by science to be, quote, humane, and to which we have evolved over time. Just read an article that hog farmers in Russia are complaining as they are only making $100 per hundredweight U.S. profit, a far cry from our ongoing negative 30. I bet I know what would happen to these left-wing idiots if they tried their same tactics over there. Hint, not all of the techniques of the former USSR have likely disappeared. Perhaps we should buy them all one-way tickets. Maybe they could straighten things out over there before they look like us on a larger scale. I mean, isn't that incredible?
Well,
this is the mentality, though.
They're just coming after the equivalent of the leftists' right wing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we need those
but
too.
That's
there
a big
are
part
Rush
of
Limbaugh.
This country. That's a big part of this country. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that we face.
I think it's a lot less than it was 8 years ago. When I saw all those states come up with Obama colors, what is it, the blue or the red? I was like, wow, there goes Minnesota, there's Wisconsin. There, you know, they are people that understand, and I think education is our greatest ally. And now with the internet and Obama's and Michelle making school food lunch, you know, her number one issue above all other issues.
Yeah, I mean, right, and people like Bill Telepan. And
well, read some more. There must be
more.
Oh,
I just shut it down. There's tons more. It's sort of all on the same theme.
You know, the internet and the expansion of the information superhighway, as it were, I think is also creating a climate of fear for a lot of people, because you have statistics coming out like, first of all, you have statistics coming out about the dangers of the industry, which certainly are breeding fear. But you also have statistics coming out about, like, you know, organic farming practices and you know, polyculture techniques, that these can all increase production over time. Not right away, not in your first season, but over time. So people are reading that, and they're saying there really is no need for these huge crops of monocultures to be planted in the Midwest. But the problem is, these guys have been, you know, receiving subsidies to plant this way for ages. They can't switch over.
And they
at
have
this
huge
to,
lobbies to support
permaculture.
That production.
Huge lobbies, first
huge
of all.
Huge money goes
but
into that.
But second of
that.
All, they have officially completely screwed up their land. They cannot now go there and say, oh, okay, well, let's look at
let's
permaculture techniques. And and have, you know, a closed ecosystem it's just not going to happen, because their land is so chemically treated that it's mm-hmm.
chemically treated
and anything else.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we've got ourselves stuck
and we have
a rock
Monsanto,
and
which is, you know, and companies like that, which are funneling millions and millions of dollars into governor, you know, various political bodies' mm-hmm. pockets, in order to ensure that we continue to use corn and soybean for biofuels, for example, which has created a great, that's been another aspect of agriculture that I think few people are really willing to acknowledge. But one of the reasons that that the meat industry is now sort of at odds with the crop industry is because of the biofuels scenario, in which corn and soybean, which have typically been fed to cattle and hogs and chickens at very low prices, suddenly those prices, especially last year, jumped like double and three times what they had been, and just crushed these protein producers. And that's not going to go away. And dairy farmers who have slaughtered record numbers of their herds this year. It was hundreds of thousands of dairy cattle were put down this year because dairy farmers could no longer make their money on their products, and they couldn't afford to feed the animals.
Which is another, I mean, that's another example of how, you know, the sort of
very short-sighted agricultural you know, policies in this country is really what it talks about.
Yeah, and it also speaks to the corporate majority wanting to sort of silence the any voice of dissent, because, you know, you had all these dairy farmers switching over to organic because organic milk was fetching such a higher price.
Right.
And you had, you know, especially in Pennsylvania, there was a huge movement by the governor was supportive of it, and several other folks who wanted to shut down the organic dairy's ability to label their milk as such, because their feeling was saying that it's hormone free or antibiotic free implies that there's something wrong with adding hormones or antibiotics to dairy, which obviously there's not. I mean, what could be wrong with that?
Gee, so, I don't know. What could be wrong with that?
If you label
when your
milk,
child starts menstruating at age 8 and is growing breasts,
seriously, and
yeah, I wouldn't be worried about that.
Illness that's not responding to the penicillin that your doctor's prescribed, you know. So, but you know, it's really interesting, because it's like this is it's one more example of how the mainstream really does not want to allow the sort of the fringe voice in the conversation whatsoever, because
I mean, the social change always seems to come on the fringe, and then it just seeps over to 52%, and then changes
right.
made,
and then changes happen.
Environmental.
Well, Patrick, you're
suffrage.
A meat dealer. I mean, what's your take on it? You've been doing Heritage Foods for what, about 8 years?
Yeah,
is it that long?
No, 2002 was our first.
Okay, 7 years.
So what's my...
Yeah, what's your take? Like, your business has grown. I know that you deal mostly to restaurants. But,
we're 70% restaurants, or I would say 75%.
And then 30% is 25 to 30% is mail order.
I like the idea of you out on the corner being like, meat, got your meat, pork.
Yeah, exactly. I
got
actually,
a nickel bag of ground.
In the tax bracket, there is a tax bracket for... there's a tax bracket for door-to-door salesmen that I fall into.
No way. Yeah. Well, you are a door-to-door salesman.
Well, although now I can say, you know, we're not growing exponentially like Nyman did. We're staying small.
Willie Loman of meat over here.
Which allows...
Anastasia, you are funny, girl.
So, but what we are doing is we're definitely, you know, seeing that our customers are starting to buy with us more consistently. They understand. So standing orders are easier to maintain. But it took many, many, many years to get those types of relationships going.
Well, now the next challenge for you is to get your product into institutional.
Well, actually, I'm very happy you bring that up because Emory University, for the first time, about 1,600 students... They're buying a pallet of Frank's turkeys for the second year in a row.
Great.
And they're doing a big... And I think that's really great because
institutions
carry a lot of power.
Did you read that blog I sent
you? Just think if, you know, the VIP lounge at Madison Square Garden...
Yeah, or if they had all organic meats.
Columbia University's professor
dining
hall.
Absolutely. Well, Cornell
has
a big program going, and they took over that tomato processing plant, and they're doing, like, their own tomato sauce, and they're trying to get... One of the biggest problems, which we hardly ever talk about, is the absence of slaughterhouses and processing plants anywhere but in the Midwest. And I know that Bill Nyman has said, well, you know, that's where all the industry is. It should stay there. We should all be shipping our cattle there. But there's no reason why there's only one slaughterhouse in New York State or one slaughterhouse in Pennsylvania. There's a lot of cattle grown around here.
I don't think the future... is that the Northeast will be producing the majority of its meat consumption, but I do think there should be more. I mean, I still think the Midwest is the meat breadbasket, just because of sheer space, sheer tradition, infrastructure. Like, I don't know that
skilled workers.
We should become more independent.
Yeah, very small scale. Let's say somebody has a little bit of land and they want to have a pig or they want to have a goat or... Michael Pollan had a great idea, which is mobile slaughterhouses, mobile abattoirs. I love it. I think we should get all those Oscar Mayer Wiener mobiles and convert them. You know,
you could do it. And, you know, suburban is a big part. We talk urban all the time, vertical farming. We almost had that guy Despomeon or roof gardens. But
suburban wasteland is, yes.
Yeah, there's
huge,
a lot of land.
Huge.
And there you could have, you know, goats and stuff with a lot greater
Absolutely.
Ease.
You know, I have a friend who's turning 99 in February. And
wow, when was she born? 2000.
She was born in 1911.
Wow.
And she grew up on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, around 116th Street. And she remembers when there were goats, pigs, and chickens walking around in the streets.
Wow.
There were so many. She lived in a house, like just a three-story house.
And Wall Street, too, that whole downtown area, which just had so much food. It was like where most of the population was in like the 1880s. I mean, there were pigs there, too.
Yeah.
Right. I love that idea for you know, these food deserts of Brooklyn. And there are places where there's no supermarket for miles around and people are forced to shop at bodegas. What if you had like a goat herder with his little flute, you know, he's got his goat. It's a herd of goats, or you could keep them on leashes.
That's so Greek of you.
You hear the flute, and you run downstairs with your bottle, and you get some goat's milk.
That's not bad.
I'm grooving on that idea. Well, the next time, we're going to also have, later on in the season, we're going to have somebody from the Narragansett Creamery who's going to talk about the rise in interest in cheesemaking. And not only are people going for the DIY butchering, but they're going for the DIY cheesemaking. And I think that's
and
a really neat. Yeah.
Everything.
I think this is a theme that's worth exploring again and again and again.
Well, I like this format for the Q to come back, or Park Q to come and talk in depth, more editorializing, whereas the first hour is more interview. I like the way this worked today.
Oh, good. Yeah, me too. So
was I on air when I said that?
Yeah.
Did I say that out loud?
I think it's okay if we can just...
We're sponsored by Fairway. We should thank Steve Ray
Jenkins,
and all those guys
so
at Fairway.
Thank you so much, and all of the partners at Fairway for sponsoring Heritage Radio Network.
This is the
Radio
first
Network.
Show that they've ever sponsored, and it's going to be one of about, I think, 30 shows are going to have them as sponsors.
Oh, bless their hearts.
FairwayMarket.com.
That's FairwayMarket.com.
Is it like other markets?
It's like no other market.
No, it's not. Not at all.
It's like no other market. Okay. Read
you can shop online,
lips.
Though. It's really incredible, the online store.
You can
they
shop
have
online,
here, yeah.
But you should also check out the store because the variety of products. I mean, everybody knows Fairway. It's an institution. Yeah. But still, for those of you who have not really plumbed the depths, oh my God, it's just it's a golden mecca of fabulous food products.
All right. Put Steve's shirt back on in your mind.
Yeah, I could get really poetic about this.
So we never even got to talk about the fundraiser, but we'll do
oh,
that
well,
next
let's
time.
Mention it right now. What's the fundraiser?
We yeah, have another well, couple. We have some
turn the music
up.
Down for a
up.
Second. I want to hear 1 minute about this. This was a big event.
Yeah, we had our first fundraiser for the farm, the rooftop farm that we're building. We had it here, and we had a great turnout. We sold out a 100-person event. We had a great auction.
Thanks for mentioning Heritage.
And and Liberty Science. We did it in conjunction with Liberty Science Center. They're doing a huge exposition on... cooking, science of cooking.
What was
science
auctioned?
Oh, well, we should have somebody on from Liberty to talk about it.
Yeah, I think it's going
to talk
really
about the exhibition. Yeah. I'm going to call them this week.
We auctioned Gabe McMacken. He will be cooking dinner at Joe Bastianich's house.
I thought
house.
It was Gabe Rosner that they no, was going to no, cook no. for everybody.
That would probably be a. I don't know. I've
That's
never.
That's a $20 purchase. Right there.
I'm like, you know, does that mean what? He places the call and then goes to. Pick up the,
yeah,
the food.
But Anastasia, what's the name of your organization? How can people
you
learn
know,
more
we,
about you?
We don't really have a name yet, but go to...
That always comes last with good ideas.
Yeah.
You think Slow Food thought of that first? They thought of Slow Food last.
But we will be having other fundraisers, so keep checking out Roberta's website. It's going to be a really cool project and hopefully one that other people can replicate very easily.
And by the way, you should definitely get your space checked out before you start trucking hundreds of pounds of dirt
oh,
up
yes,
onto the roof.
Yes.
Get an architect.
Yes.
Have a structural engineer
Absolutely,
come up and
there
evaluate.
Will be a structural engineer.
Yeah, because my brother did a rooftop garden and he had a box with 600 pounds of dirt in it and it started to go right through the floor.
600 pounds of dirt is also nothing.
Hold on. Let's actually, Jack, cut to the... it's a very good garden. It's very temperate up there. Could you cut to the mic up there, Jack, so we can hear what's going on in the garden?
Yeah, hold on a second. It's a little bit rainy.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So you guys really have
a loon somewhere up here.
It's nice and warm and wet.
Yeah.
Yes, those jungle birds are really a problem, though. They're
yeah, but think of all the great nitrates that they deliver to the soil.
So for more on this fundraiser, we actually luckily recorded most of the night here at the radio station.
Some brilliant radio on
You can
there.
Listen to interviews with Joe Bastianich. I think Tom Eiland was here. Bunch of other people. So
and
it was
who were the guys from which Snacky Tune brother?
Darren was there, and a very drunk Brandon Hoy throughout the night.
He
so
was
it's,
funny.
So it's
oh,
good
he was,
stuff.
He was funny.
Oh, Brandon is the best.
Oh yeah.
So and what were the five largest packers? Did we ever mention that?
We did.
Yes. Jacqueline did pull that up. And
Jacqueline, read it away.
Let's see. We have Cargill, Tyson, Smithfield, Swift & Co., and Farmland Industries.
Farmland Industries, by the way, that isn't that the
Never
big milk,
that.
The dairy product? They're the dairy product.
Oh, they kill the dairy cows?
No, I mean, small farms kill their dairy product.
Yeah, which is so frustrating, though, because, you know, you have these names in your mind as sort of like the things to avoid, but they actually encompass, like, so many of the smaller companies.
Hundreds and hundreds of producers are tied into the Tyson, the Smithfields,
and they must
the,
be preserved.
And the Swift.
It's the greedy
middlemen. We're
going to
do more on the big guys in subsequent shows.
Of which Heritage is not one.
Yeah, and we're going to have some of those representatives on this airwaves, too, I promise. This has been the Main Course Part Q on Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by Fairway. And thank you, Anastasia, for joining
Thanks
us today.
For
You've been a wonderful
me.
Guest. Yeah, come back.
Awesome.
Okay, bye, you guys. See you next week.